Well, good evening. You want to be turning in your Bibles to 2 Samuel in chapter 18. And just a few words to put this chapter in context. Okay. Ignore him. He's hard to. Have you ever noticed? He said, just ignore me. Have you ever tried ignoring a guy that size? You're right. Exactly. So the last time I spoke, a lot of people were away, and some are away tonight at Mountaintop. Last night there was, the last time I spoke, there was, a dozen people here or something? So it might be helpful just to put things into context so we can sort of understand where we are in the big scheme of things. So in 2 Samuel chapter 15, we see David fleeing Jerusalem. It's really a sad picture, a king in exile while his son Absalom attempts to take over the kingship. And he leaves weeping, and he cries out to God in desperation there in chapter 15. He says in verse 31, O Lord, I pray thee, turn the counsel of Ahithophel into foolishness. Ahithophel, you will recall, had been his trusted advisor, loyal to him, a man whose advice and wisdom was highly regarded. But he had jumped ship, and now he was siding with Absalom in his rebellion against his father. Somewhat easy to understand when you recognize that Ahithophel was Bathsheba's grandfather. So David cries out to God to turn the counsel of Ahithophel into foolishness. Well, we learn later in that chapter and into chapter 17 what that counsel was. The last part of chapter 16, Ahithophel recommends to Absalom that he take and go into his father's concubines, which was quite an insult. That was part of the kingly harem, if you will. And it was quite an insult to David, but he did so, and he made that public knowledge. Well, that counsel continued into chapter 17, where Ahithophel outlines a plan whereby David would be killed. And so that plan was presented to Absalom. And as we noted last time, that plan was all about Ahithophel. It was about what Ahithophel will do. He says there, let me choose out 12,000 men, and I will arise, and I will pursue after David, and I will come upon him when he's weak and weary, and I will smite the king only, and I'll bring back the people. It's all about what I will do. Okay, well, knowing something about Absalom and his nature and his character, he was a bit full of himself, you might say, just to sum it all up. And the fact that Ahithophel was front and center rather than himself, well, that didn't sit well with Absalom. So he thought, well, I'll get a second opinion. I'll get the opinion of David's friend Hushai. And so he called Hushai in, and Hushai outlined an alternate plan whereby David might be apprehended. Of course, Hushai was David's friend. He was undercover. He was acting in David's behalf. And he outlined a plan whereby Absalom would receive more of the honor and the glory and the recognition for having taken David. And so all of that was to give David time to escape, which is exactly what happened. So David escapes. Now, as we look at chapters 17 and 18, this is so important. There's a verse, a part of a verse, that really puts the whole thing, everything we're going to talk about from chapter 17 to 18, really is the outworking of what we read in chapter 17 in verse 14, the second part of verse 14, and this is what we read. For the Lord had appointed to defeat the good counsel of Ahithophel to the intent that the Lord might bring evil upon Absalom. And we pointed out that though it's called the good counsel of Ahithophel, it was good tactically speaking. Morally, it was not a good thing. Okay? We made that distinction. So everything we read in chapter 17 and on into chapter 18 that we're going to look at here starting in a minute is the outworking of the sovereign plan of God whereby he had appointed to defeat the good counsel of Ahithophel to the intent that the Lord might bring evil upon Absalom. And the details of chapter 17, how that a maidservant was able to relay the message to the sons of to the son of Zadok and Abiathar and get word to David, and how that those messengers were hidden by a farmer and his wife down in a well. All of that was the outworking of that verse, how that God had appointed to defeat the good counsel of Ahithophel to the intent that the Lord might bring evil upon Absalom. So that's the big picture of what's going on here. So we come to chapter 18. We'll start by reading the first five verses where we have David's strategy laid out as he is fleeing from Absalom and on the verge of a military encounter. So chapter 18 and verse 1, "And David numbered the people that were with him and set captains of thousands and captains of hundreds over them. And David sent forth a third part of the people under the hand of Joab, and a third part under the hand of Abishai, the son of Zeruiah, Joab's brother, and a third part under the hand of Ittai the Gittite. And the king said unto the people, I will surely go forth with you myself also. But the people answered, Thou shalt not go forth, for if we flee away, they will not care for us. Neither if half of us die will they care for us. But now thou art worth 10,000 of us. Therefore, now it is better that thou succor us out of the city," or advise us from a place of safety is what that means. "And the king said unto them, What seemeth you best I will do. And the king stood by the gate side, and all the people came out by hundreds and by thousands. And the king commanded Joab and Abishai and Ittai, saying, Deal gently for my sake with the young man, even with Absalom. And all the people heard when the king gave all the captains charge concerning Absalom." So those verses outline David's strategy. He numbers the people, he divides them into thirds, and puts them under three different captains. Joab and Abishai, that were brothers, the sons of two of the three sons of Zeruiah. Zeruiah was his sister, so these were his nephews. And the third was Ittai the Gittite. Gittite just means he was from the city of Gath. He had been a Philistine that apparently, presumably, during the time that David spent in the land of the Philistines, he had accrued to himself some loyal followers, and they had come to serve David. So you've got the three commanders and the troops divided into thirds, and David was wanting to go with them into battle, and they said, no, it's too risky. You stay here where it's safe, and you can direct us from a safe location. And so he agreed to that. And then he gives this all-important instructions to those three captains. He says, deal gently for my sake with the young man, even with Absalom. Deal gently with Absalom. Now, again, let's not lose sight of the big picture of what's going on here. You see, David understood God's big plan. Back in chapter 7, when God declared to David that even after he died, that there would be a son that would rise to power, and that ultimately the Messiah was going to be the Son of David, one whose reign would last forever and ever and ever and extend all over the world. And David understood that. David took God at his word. And so God had a plan, and David was at the center of that plan, and David understood that. And if you go back, for example, if you back up 10 chapters to chapter 8, which is the chapter that follows that promise that was made to David by God about how that he was going to have a son whose kingdom would whose reign would never end. In the next chapter, we have outlined for us David subduing his enemies. And you see, this is the point I want to make. David understood what God was doing. And David understood that those that stood in opposition to him stood in opposition to God. David's enemies were God's enemies. David knew that. David understood that. And so David's actions were sort of driven by that. That's what moved him. That's why he defeated all those nations in chapter 8. And that's a picture of what David's greater son's going to do when he comes back. He's going to defeat all oppositions. He's going to put every enemy under his feet. And every knee is going to bow and every tongue is going to confess. And so David understood that. And so his understanding that all those that opposed him opposed God, he also understood that that applied even to his own son, even to his own son who was his enemy. And God and the enemies of God needed to be dealt with. And I think it's hard for us, it's just easy to read right through this, but we need to stop and think about how tough this was on David. And of course, remember, all of this goes back to what the prophet told him back in chapter 7, that your sin is going to have consequences and it's going to manifest itself as trouble within your family. And we're seeing that. And certainly that's exactly what happened. Tamar was raped. Amnon was murdered. Absalom goes into rebellion. Now Absalom's trying to take over the kingdom. All this traces back to David's sin. And so Absalom was David's enemy at this point. And David's enemies were God's enemies and needed to be dealt with. And yet he's in a bind because this is his son. This is his son. He knew what needed to be done. Absalom was a murderer. He was deserving of death. He was deserving of capital punishment. And he knew that when he murdered Amnon, that's why he fled for 3 years. And so anyway, David is in a tough spot. And he says to these three commanders, deal gently for my sake with the young man Absalom. You see, David, if you will, David wanted to have his cake and eat it too. He wanted to do the will of God, but at the same time, this is his son we're talking about. And so he pleads with these three captains to deal gently. And every time I read that verse, I can't help but think of a few years ago, we went up to Appomattox. Anybody been to Appomattox? That's an amazing place. That's really an amazing place. And they tell you the story about how, you know, the Civil War came to an end and Lee's troops surrendered to Grant. And part of that story there, and it's really a moving thing, you know, you're standing in the very spot where this happened, that courthouse where Robert E. Lee surrendered to Ulysses Grant. And the narrator describes how that Lee's troops were coming from this direction and from that direction. And this really happened. I mean, I get chills just thinking about it. But the part that I remember that I always think about when I read that verse where David says, deal gently with Absalom, the part that I remember was this, that under the direction of Abraham Lincoln gave instructions to Ulysses Grant in connection with those surrendered Confederate troops. This is what he said. Let them up easy. let them up easy. And he did. They're surrendering. Don't make it any harder than it has to be. Let them up easy. That in my mind, that's the equivalent of deal gently. And he did. He did. For example, one of the manifestations of that was he let the Confederate soldiers keep their horses. That might not sound like much of a big deal, but, you know, that's like you get to keep your car. Otherwise, you're Pat and Charlie, right? That was a big deal. And he let those Confederate soldiers up easy. And that's what David is saying, deal gently with Absalom. So what happens? Well, the whole battle is described in only three verses, verses 6, 7, and 8. So, verse 6, so the people went out into the field against Israel, and the battle was in the wood or in the forest of Ephraim, where the people of Israel were slain before the servants of David. And there was there a great slaughter that day of 20,000 men. For the battle was there scattered over the face of all the country, and the wood or the forest devoured more people that day than the sword devoured. It's one of those verses that's really easy to just keep right on going, read too fast, and stop and fail to understand what you just read. First of all, we recognize the fact that David was greatly outnumbered. And the location of the battle, the fact that it points out that it was in the forest of Ephraim, worked to David's advantage. And so David won the battle. 20,000 Israelite soldiers were killed. And it says there that the forest devoured or slew more than the sword slew that day. Now, I don't know what that looked like. You know, God has done unusual things in the past. He's turned the enemies of God upon themselves to fight one another and annihilate one another. He's done that on more than one occasion. We don't know how this worked out, but somehow in a supernatural way, God gave David a victory that day. Okay? The wood or the forest devoured more people that day than the sword devoured. So, David got the victory. Then we come to verse 9. And Absalom met the servants of David. And Absalom rode upon a mule, and the mule went under the thick boughs of a great oak. And his head caught hold of the oak, and he was taken up between the heaven and the earth, and the mule that was under him went away. Now, it just says that the branch of the oak, you know, got a hold of his head. Now, we know something about his hair, and most people tend to say, well, it was his hair that got caught in the branches, which just goes in the column of disadvantage of having a lot of hair on your head. I mean, I don't know that that's happened. I just imagine in my mind, all of a sudden, Absalom, he comes upon David's servants, and it's like, oh no, where'd they come from? And he takes off and he turns and he looks back to see how close they are, and the next thing you know, he gets whacked in the head by an oak branch. So he's dangling, probably by that thick hair he was so proud of, between heaven and earth. Okay? So what happens next? A certain man saw it, this is verse 10, and told Joab and said, behold, I saw Absalom hanged in an oak. And Joab said unto the man that told him, and behold, thou sawest him? You saw him? And why didst thou not smite him thence to the ground? And I would have given thee 10 shekels of silver and a girdle. Absalom says, what are you saying? Joab says to the unnamed man, is what I meant to say. Joab says, you saw him and you didn't kill him? What's wrong with you? Why didn't you smite him to the ground? I would have given you a new belt and 10 shekels of silver. I love the next verse. I love his response. Verse 12, and the man said unto Joab, though I should receive 1,000 shekels of silver in mine hand, yet would I not put forth mine hand against the king's son. For in the hearing of the king charged thee, for in our hearing the king charged thee and Abishai and Ittai, saying, beware that none touch the young man Absalom. Now you see, you go back to that verse when he gives that command, and notice it said, and all the people heard when the king gave all the captains charge concerning Absalom. It was common knowledge. They were not to lay hands on the king's son. And so when Joab says to this man, you saw him and you didn't kill him, I'd have given you a belt and 10 pieces of silver. He says, I wouldn't have done it for 1,000 pieces of silver. Why not? Because the king said so. The king said so. And I read that verse and I thought, you know, wouldn't it be something if every time we were tempted by sin, tempted for personal gain, we said, no way, because the king said no. The king said no. How different might our lives be if we had the kind of loyalty and love for David's greater son that this man had for David, and the ability, like Proverbs 1 says, if sinners entice thee, consent thou not. Say no. Say no. No, I wouldn't do it. I wouldn't do it for 10 pieces of silver. I wouldn't do it for 1,000 pieces of silver, because the king said, don't do it. And that's the kind of loyalty that God looks for from us, to have that kind of respect and love for our king, David's greater son, that when occasions like that present themselves to us, we have the strength to say, no, no, I'm not going to do it. I'm not going to compromise. This is what the king said, and that's what I'm going to do. Forget, you know, buy the truth, Proverbs 23:23, buy the truth and sell it not. Don't compromise the truth. If God says don't do it, don't do it. So, we come to verse 13. So he reminds Joab of what David had said, that they were commanded not to touch the young man. Otherwise, I should have wrought falsehood against mine own life, for there is no matter hid from the king, and thou thyself wouldst have set thyself against me. In other words, I would have no guarantee, had I put him to death, I would have no guarantee that you would have my back. That's basically, in modern terms, what he's saying there. So Joab responds in verse 14, then said Joab, I may not tarry thus with thee. And in other words, I'm done talking with you, okay? And he took 3 darts in his hand and thrust them through the heart of Absalom while he was yet alive in the midst of the oak. And 10 young men that bore Joab's armor compassed about and smote Absalom and slew him. And Joab blew the trumpet, and the people returned from pursuing after Israel, for Joab held back the people. And they took Absalom and cast him into a great pit in the wood and laid a very great heap of stones upon him. And all Israel fled, everyone to his tent. Now Absalom, in his lifetime, had taken and reared up for himself a pillar, which is in the king's dale. For he said, I have no son to keep my name in remembrance. And he called the pillar after his own name, and it is called unto this day Absalom's place. Now, how ironic. Here was a man that, you know, I'm not going to go back all through it. We've seen something about his nature and his character, how that, you know, he was outstanding. He was super handsome, no blemish from the sole of his feet to the top of his head. He had that hair that was so renowned, and he was winsome in his personality. He stole the hearts of the people of Israel, and he was very ambitious. He wanted the kingship so badly, he was willing to kill his own father for it. And he also was concerned that he be well remembered. So he erected a monument to himself. Humble sort of fellow, right? He erected a monument to himself that he might always be remembered by this monument in the Kingsdale, the place where kings were buried, okay? He wanted to make sure he was remembered in a positive way. Well, you know what? Didn't work out like he had planned. You know why? For the Lord had appointed to defeat the good counsel of Ahithophel to the intent that the Lord might bring evil upon Absalom. Absalom had great plans for himself. You know, he ended up with two burial places. His actual burial place was in a pit out in the woods. They dug a hole and threw his lifeless body in the pit and covered it with rocks. That's how he ended his life. How he had imagined was he would have this glorious monument to himself and people would remember him and say wonderful things about himself. You see, he was ambitious for all the wrong reasons. We read in Jeremiah chapter 45 and verse 5, we read this. Seekest thou great things for thyself? Seek them not. Seek them not. You see, Absalom sought great things for himself. And look at how he ended. Look at how he ended in shame. You know, it's quite a contrast when you think about what God had to say about Abraham, for example. Go all the way back to Genesis chapter 12 when God called Abraham and he made those promises to him. And one of the things that God said to Abraham in Genesis 12 and verse 2 is this. He said, I will make thy name great. I will make thy name great. Similarly, what God said to David in 2 Samuel chapter 7, he says, I made your name great. There's nothing wrong with having a great name if it's God that makes the name great. You know, the verse in Jeremiah says, seekest thou great things for thyself? There's nothing wrong with seeking greatness. What's wrong is seeking greatness for yourself. Like the people at the Tower of Babel, they wanted to make a name for themselves. They wanted a tower up to God. God would have nothing to do with it. There's no future in seeking a name for yourself. If God, by His grace and mercy, wants to make your name great, so be it. There's nothing wrong with that. In fact, God commends greatness. The Lord has a lot to say about greatness. We ought to aspire to greatness. And what did the Lord Jesus say about greatness? If you want to be great in the kingdom of God, learn to be a what? A servant. And so the Lord Jesus encourages us to seek for greatness. But it's God's definition of greatness. It's learning to be a servant. You want to be great in God's kingdom? Learn to be a servant. He that would be chiefest among you is going to be he that serves. He kept talking about the importance of servanthood. And so the Lord puts a premium on servanthood. He says, that's how you want to be great. You want to be great in that estimation, in God's estimation. So there's nothing wrong with seeking greatness, but there is something wrong with seeking greatness for yourself. And that's exactly what Absalom did. Made a monument to himself, and he ended up thrown in a hole in the ground in the woods with some rocks piled over it. Seekest thou great things for thyself? Seek them not. God said to Abraham and God said to David, I'll make your name great. You just love me. You just follow me. You just be obedient to me, and I'll take care of the rest. So that's what we see. So anyway, verse 19. Then said Ahimaaz, the son of Zadok, let me now run and bear the king tidings how that the Lord hath avenged him of his enemies. Let me be the one to give David the news, he says. And Joab said unto him, now that's Ahimaaz is Zadok's son, okay? Joab said unto him, thou shalt not bear tidings this day, but thou shalt bear tidings another day. In other words, not today, but this day thou shalt bear no tidings because the king's son is dead. The king's son is dead, and you shall not bear those tidings to the king. Then said Joab to Cushai, and some people think that that's just an unnamed Cushite. We don't know whether that was his proper name or just the description. Go tell the king what thou hast seen. And Cushai bowed himself unto Joab and ran. So he says no to Ahimaaz's request to go give the word to the king that Absalom is dead. But he does give permission to Cushai. Then said Ahimaaz, the son of Zadok, yet again to Joab. He's persistent, you see. But howsoever, let me, I pray thee, please, pretty please, with a cherry on top, please let me go and give David the news. Let me also run after Cushai. And Joab said, wherefore wilt thou run, my son, seeing thou hast no tidings ready? But howsoever, said he, let me run. He was so persistent. And he said unto him, run. He finally gave in, okay? Joab gives in. Then Ahimaaz ran by the way of the plain and overran Cushai. He outran him, okay? So Joab initially says, Ahimaaz, no, you can't do it. Cushai is going to do it. Cushai takes off, but Ahimaaz was a better runner, outran him, and got there first, as we're going to see. In verse 24, and David sat between the two gates. And the watchman went up to the roof over the gate under the wall and lifted up his eyes and looked, and behold, a man running alone. And the watchman cried and told the king. And the king said, if he be alone, there is tidings in his mouth. And he came apace and drew near. I want to pause just for a moment. And I want to go back to that phrase in the first part of verse 24. And I want us to try to think about what David must have been thinking and what David must have been feeling. And David sat between the two gates. We read about Absalom suspended between heaven and earth. And now we see David between the two gates. And I think about those gates and what they might represent. And you think about, you know, here's David. If this is his son that is in rebellion against him, that's ready to kill him. But it's his son. And God has a plan, and David is at front and center of that plan. And David understands what God is doing, and David understands that all enemies of his are enemies of God, and the enemies of God must be put down. And that even means his own son. So here he's got, I mean, regardless of what of Absalom had ever done with all of his sin and wickedness and so forth and deception, in spite of that, he was still his son. And so David is torn. He's between the two gates. You know, if you go back to that chapter I referred to, chapter 8, where it outlines David's victory over all of his kingdom, all of his enemies, how he strengthened and enlarged his kingdom, I want you to notice what it says in verse 15 of that chapter. It says, and David reigned over all Israel. And now listen to this. And David executed judgment and justice unto all his people. David executed justice and judgment unto all his people. You see, he was a man after God's heart. And that's what God expected kings to do. To execute justice and judgment. Well, justice and judgment demanded that Absalom be put to death because he had murdered a man, Amnon, his brother. And Absalom is the consummate rebellious son. There are a lot of charges that can be brought against Absalom that qualify him to be put to death. And here's David between the gates, wondering, how is the battle going? Who's winning? Where's Absalom? Have they secured him? Is he safe? Is he alive? What's the status of Absalom? David is in a quandary. He's between the two gates, and here come these two runners. And you know what David is trying to balance, and this is really what we need to try to grasp. And it's I would never want to be in this situation, but David was torn, as it were, between the two gates, because on the one side, you've got justice and judgment, which is what God expected kings to do, to exercise. And on the other side, on the other gate, you've got love. You've got love and you've got justice. And how is this going to play out? Is he going to let love prevail? If so, it's going to be at the expense of justice. If he lets justice prevail, it's going to be at the expense of love. How is it going to play out? David was in a bind of his own making, like so many of our problems. They're of our own making. And here's David. He's between the gates. And he sees these runners. And so the watchman, verse 26, sees another man running. And the watchman called unto the porter and said, "Behold, another man runs alone." And the king said, "He also brings tidings." And the watchman said, verse 27, "Methinketh the running of the foremost is like the running of Ahimaaz, the son of Zadok." And the king said, "He is a good man and cometh with good tidings." Oh, I hope they're good tidings. David's heart was torn. David was agonizing over the fate of Absalom. What's he going to do? Is Absalom alive? What's his status? What am I going to do? What am I going to do? I'm in a tremendous bind here. What am I going to do? He's a good man. If that first runner is Ahimaaz, he's a good man, and surely he's bringing good tidings. Oh, I hope he's bringing good tidings. So what happens? Ahimaaz called and said unto the king, "All is well." He fell down to the earth upon his face before the king and said, "Blessed be the Lord thy God, which hath delivered up the men that lifted up their hand against my lord the king," which is a nice sort of a political way of saying your son's dead without saying it. And the king said, is the young man Absalom safe? That's all I care about. That's all I want to know. Tell me about my son. Tell me about Absalom. And Ahimaaz answered, "When Joab sent the king's servant and me thy servant, I saw a great tumult, but I knew not what it was." Sort of a non-answer. And the king said to him, "Turn aside." In other words, I'm getting nowhere with you. You step aside and stand here. And he turned aside and stood still. And behold, Cushai came, the one that Ahimaaz had overcome. And Cushai said, "Tidings, my lord the king, for the Lord hath avenged thee this day of all them that rose up against thee," which is sort of a nice, sensitive way, you might say, of letting the king know his son is dead. And the king said unto Cushai, same exact wording that he said to Ahimaaz. He says, "Is the young man Absalom safe?" I don't want to hear about anything else. I just want to know, tell me about my son. Is he safe? Is he okay? Is the young man Absalom safe? And Cushai answered, "The enemies of my lord the king and all that rise against thee to do thee hurt be as that young man is," which is a political way of saying he's dead. Absalom is dead. And David understood it. He got it. And the last verse says, "And the king was much moved and went up to the chamber over the gate and wept. And as he went, thus he said, O my son Absalom, my son Absalom, would God I had died for thee, O Absalom, my son, my son." You can't read that verse without feeling the heartbreak of David. And you know, I don't think it's reading too much into the verse to see something of David's guilt. You know, he says, I would have died for thee. See, you know, David understood that because of the sins that he had committed, murder and adultery, he deserved to die. He knew that. All you got to do is read his penitential psalms, and it becomes very clear. David was broken by his own sin. He knew that that he was guilty, and he was living with that guilt, and he was living with the consequences of his sin. And so he says, if I could have just died in his place. Now, this is in the place of a rebellious son. And yet he was his son. Our children, in spite of what they may do, they're always our children. And so we see him just pouring out his heart in grief over the loss of his son Absalom. And there he is in that bind between those two gates, as it were, love on one side and justice on the other. And how can they be reconciled? How can one be true without compromising the other? Well, that's the problem that David faced. You know, as I think about that, I think about, you know, as God looks down on us, as God looks down on me, what did he see? What did he see? He saw a rebellious son. He saw someone worthy of death. And so how is God going to respond? You've got those two things that are normally mutually exclusive, love and justice. One has to give way to the other under normal circumstances. If we exercise love, it's at the expense of justice. If we exercise justice, then we're accused of being unloving. So how is all this going to be resolved? How did God resolve what he saw when he looked at me and you and he says, there's a rebellious son. What am I going to do? I love that son, but he's rebellious and deserves to die. What was that song Nancy was playing? What was the name of it? Love Found a Way. Love Found a Way. And God found a way to forgive us, demonstrate his love towards us without compromising his justice. What an amazing God. That he might be just and the justifier of them that believe in Jesus. And God found a way, as it were, between those two gates. He brought those two gates together at a place called Calvary. And without compromising his love, he executed justice because he executed it against his son. Without compromising his love, he executed justice. And without compromising his justice, he exercised love. Love found a way.
Praise requests.
That was Wes calling.
Praise items, prayer requests.